Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today, we are thrilled to welcome Natalie Johnson Medcalf, president and a volunteer of For Love of Dog Rescue. Natalie brings with her a wealth of knowledge and a deep passion for animal welfare. For Love of Dog Rescue, founded in 2005, has been a beacon of hope for over 6,000 dogs, providing them with medical care, love, and a path to adoption. Natalie, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
Give us the history of For Love of Dog Rescue. How did it come to be?
So our founder is Kish Mackin. She started the rescue in 2005, primarily funding from her own pocket, putting vet bills on her personal credit card as you're trying to kind of establish yourself in the community, get your 501c3 nonprofit number. You know, that's all a process. And then since 2005, we've taken in roughly just over 6,000 dogs.
What is your role? You're the president.
Currently, my role is the president. I've had the seat for about 3 years. I'm a vet tech. So my job within the rescue is primarily handling medical needs. That is things like wellness exams, getting spay-neuter scheduled, working on medical clauses for our dogs that have kind of ongoing medical conditions like diabetes or thyroid conditions. So my role falls into making sure that everybody's medical needs are fulfilled and ongoing care is scheduled before they're ready to be placed available for adoption.
And we want to get into everything about adoption and what that means.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot really to understand. Let's start at the very beginning.
Sure.
How do dogs come to you?
So we get our dogs from a few different ways. First kind of step that we take is pulling dogs from our local and regional pounds. So we work with pounds in our area along with the other rescues in our community, kind of who has space, can take dogs in at a time. If a pound needs help, they reach out and ask us to pull dogs that are kind of at the end of their mandated pound stay. Everybody gets a certain amount of business days depending on the city laws. And once their stay is up, if they are deemed adoptable, medically, behaviorally, they reach out to rescues and ask if we are able to take them in. Another way that we get them is from, we work with a few regional reservations. So as strays come in, the reservations will look for rescues that are able to help. The populations are really high on reservations. So we try to take these guys in whenever we can. Lastly is owner surrenders. Owner surrenders come to us for a variety of reasons. Owners find themselves in financial or health situations where they're no longer able to provide care. They may become overwhelmed with the number of dogs that they have in their care, and they will reach out to us to offer assistance. If a dog becomes injured, has an accident that needs a lot of medical care, they're personally not able to provide, they will reach out to us to surrender the dog so they can get the care that they need.
I bet sometimes you have to say no.
We do have to say no, and it's always devastating. You know, when we consider what we take in, it's what we have space for. We can't take every dog in. We try to help as many as we can, but if there are behavioral conditions that prohibit us from taking them in or space limitations that prohibit us from taking them in, we ultimately need fosters before we can bring these guys in. We do have a space, but it's not meant to be permanent housing for these guys. Our facility space is meant to be kind of a landing spot for them to come in so we can get to know a little bit more about them before we place them with a foster home.
So once a dog then is received,
yes,
what happens next?
So we do an intake procedure, and what that involves is just vaccinating, microchipping, providing them with flea and tick medication, deworming. We make sure that we have a foster home, and then I come in, and that's when I schedule vet visits for things as simple as just wellness examinations and heartworm and flea and tick testing or tick disease testing, getting them scheduled for neuters, getting them scheduled for spays, kind of taking care of any immediate medical concerns, whether they be urgent or not, determines kind of what kind of timeline or appointment that they might need. Once they have come into the rescue, their medical needs have been addressed. We've figured out a little bit about their personalities, so we know if they're good with cats, if they're good with other dogs, if they like kids, if they need a quiet house. Some of these guys really need a dog friend to make them feel comfortable. Once we have that information, at that point, they're ready to be listed on our website as being available.
You've talked about fosters.
Yeah.
What are fosters?
So fosters are the lifeline of our rescue. Fosters are people within our community that open up their homes to the dogs in the rescue to provide them a safe landing space while they wait for their forever home.
So they're not waiting here.
No. So the most dogs that we'll have in our facility at a time is typically about 7. Because we don't have a staff, we're all volunteer, we have to get shifts of volunteers to come 3 times a day. And it can be complicated to get people to come during the middle of the day on a work week. And if we're able to get these guys into an actual home, we're able to learn a lot more about them. We're able to help them with crate training, with potty training. We know their personality a lot better. You can work on routine and structure. The facility is great, and we're really lucky and fortunate to have it, but a foster home is really the most ideal setting.
Is it hard for a dog to be in a foster and then have to go to a new family?
It's always a transition, right? Like anytime they're experiencing new things, and dogs are really incredibly resilient, and the watching them come into the rescue, leaving either the pound or their family, and being afraid, but then watching them become confident and become a normal dog and play with toys and jump on the couch and do things that dogs do, it's really incredible. And it is a transition for them when they go from getting comfortable in their foster home to being adopted. But we really try to work with our adopters so that they understand that you need to give them space and you need to give them time to acclimate to you and your family and your routine. We can't explain to them, right? They don't know really what's happening, and it's a lot of change for them. But most of the time, given the appropriate amount of time to decompress and settle in, they really do quite well.
So here we are at the holidays.
Yes.
Is the holidays a good time for people to adopt? And I ask that question because I wonder if emotions get in the way of good decision making.
Certainly. So, you know, we all have this Lady and the Tramp vision in our head of like unboxing the little puppy with the big bow under the Christmas tree, right? And for some families, that might work and that might be great. And if you want to adopt a pet during the holiday, as long as you plan for that and take the dog's needs into account, I think that that's okay. But you should always keep in mind, are you traveling? Are you going to have a lot of people at your home? Are you going to be gone a lot? These can be a bit complicated when you're bringing a new family member in. So if you are going to adopt and you are going to be busy, making sure that you allow space in your home for the dog to have an opportunity to kind of get away from the craziness, not making everyone in your family meet the dog, like that's not necessary. Like let them have time to settle in and feel comfortable in your space before you bring in a bunch of other people. They don't really know you yet. So you want to form that relationship and that bond first before you start introducing everybody else to them.
What do you tell folks about a dog's breed, a dog's size, their energy level, and how to evaluate whether that dog will fit their lifestyle?
Sure. So we have an incredible team of adoption coordinators, and our adoption application is very lengthy, and some people say too lengthy, but we do that really on purpose because we want to set the adopters and the dogs in our care up for success. So we talk a lot about how much exercise are you willing to do. If you want to have a dog that's a complete couch potato with you, that's okay. But we probably shouldn't apply for a very young, very active breed. We try to work as a team to find not necessarily a breed specifically, but a personality that's going to be a really good match for your energy and activity level and what you're willing to do. Some of these breeds are so smart and they need a lot of mental stimulation as well as physical stimulation, where other breeds are just perfectly content to just lay on the couch and veg and watch TV with you.
There are dog rescues across North Dakota.
Yes.
Are there more dogs or more people wanting to adopt? I'm worried that it's more dogs.
Right now, it kind of feels like more dogs. I feel like all of us across the country, you don't have to go very far into social media to find that rescues are scrambling and dogs are coming in faster than they're going out. We're lucky in our community that we don't have the stray dog population that other communities have to deal with. And a lot of our dogs are getting adopted every week, but we do have a lot of dogs that are waiting to come in and owner surrenders that are waiting for us to have space to let them in. And every day there's medical dogs that are needing to come in emergent, and the pounds are very full. So I think a lot of us are feeling very overwhelmed that there's only so much that everyone can do. And it's always the concern of what happens to those dogs that we just can't make space for.
What do you tell people about the long-term commitments and responsibilities of dog ownership? I'm thinking about exercising, training, and health care, especially those folks that maybe have never had a dog before.
Yeah, there's a lot for people to think about when you bring a new dog in. And I always, you know, when I'm getting a puppy foster to their adoptive home, I always am making sure that we're having those conversations about this dog is potentially going to be with you for 10 to 12 to 14 years. There's a lot of ongoing medical cost. Yes, you're taking a baby in, they're going to have a lifetime of training and socialization with adult dogs that have come into the rescue. Maybe they didn't start out with the best background in training and socializing. So you're going to have to put that work in. And, you know, we have to be really blunt with adopters that if they aren't willing or don't seem able to put the work in, the time in, maybe adopting at this time isn't going to be the best option for them.
Wonder about older folks who have trouble getting out and about during winter.
Yeah, certainly. It is.
They'll need exercise.
Absolutely, they do. And it's really important, again, that we kind of go back to that adoption coordinating team and making sure that we are pairing those adopters with a really appropriate dog for them. So I don't ever want to tell someone who is above a certain age that you can only adopt a dog of above a certain age, but the priority is making everyone feel successful. So if you are physically limited for whatever the reason may be, we should pair you with a dog that maybe has less need for physical stimulation and exercise, and maybe a dog that is going to be more content to do some simple in-home training exercises and puzzles and things that are not so physically demanding of their owner.
Is it ever the case, Natalie, that all the intentions were good? The person really wanted to have a dog for all of the right reasons, but for whatever reason at home, it just didn't work.
It does. It happens. And again, that's one of the reasons our process is so lengthy is we try to make sure that adoptions are going to stick. You know, no one wants to take a dog home. No one thinks that they're going to be bringing a dog home to have to bring it back. It gets a little bit complicated when people have resident dogs or have dogs in their house or cats already. Ultimately, the cats and dogs that live in the house really decide if it's going to work or not, right? Because they have to figure out how to live together. And, you know, sometimes you bring a dog home and it just doesn't fit. And we understand that, and we have what we call a return period within the rescue where it gives people a couple of weeks just to make sure that things are going to work out and settle in. And if it's not going great, we try to offer resources. Here's some tips. Here's what we know about this dog. Here's a couple of handouts for some basic exercises that we have found effective. We try to direct them towards training, whether it be in a class or one-on-one session, to make them feel more confident in this new dog that they don't really know yet. So unfortunately, sometimes it doesn't work, and it is always really sad for everyone involved, but we try to set everyone up for a successful adoption.
We're really enjoying our conversation with Natalie Johnson-Metka. She is a president and a volunteer at For Love of Dog Rescue. Natalie, what about mixed breeds? I'm sure you get many, and people might want to come in and, I want a doodle, so I want this or that. How does that work?
I find in my experience that it's not always that people end up adopting the dog that they apply for. You kind of have in your mind what you think you want. And I feel like it's really important to get out and get to adoption events so that you can meet a bunch of different dogs. So we have every month at PetSmart, we have Meet the Dog events. The dates are on our website. Dogs that are appropriate to be there, and appropriate just means PetSmart has rules about them being spayed and neutered. They need to be dog friendly to be at these events. But it gets you a bunch of dogs in one space. So you can kind of see different personalities, meet different breeds. There are restrictions in people's housing that they can't have particular breeds. They can't be above a certain weight. So there's a lot of reasons why people come in, and there's some people that just want the doodle, right? And we do get the doodle in, but we also have you know, 55 other wonderful dogs on the website. And if it doesn't work out, I always tell people, don't limit yourself to one thing, because you might end up with a breed or that or a size or that you never thought that you would have in your home.
Is that how people generally select dogs, is through an event like that or through personal discussion with you?
I feel like people most of the time just do it based on the pictures.
The website. So,
yeah, exactly. Or our social media. We try to highlight all the new dogs that are going to be available that week. We'll put out a post like, these are the new kids on the block. These are our new dogs that are coming available this week. And I always tell adopters that if you, you know, there's certain dogs that are really popular, like everybody loves the little fluffy dog. And I say, if you miss out on one, there's always every week going to be new dogs that come out, and just keep checking the site, keep watching our social media. You're not limited to just the dog you put on your application. So if that doesn't work out, you can always request to meet other dogs once your application has been approved.
What are the most common misconceptions that people have about dog rescue that you might want to address?
I feel like we get a lot that we are making it too hard for people to adopt, or that we're in it for the money, or that we're making profit off of adoptions. And for us in particular, I can't speak to every rescue, but our adoption fee for an adult dog is $250. And on average, we're spending about $650 per dog. And if in medical care, spaying, neutering, wellness, vaccinations, microchipping. And if you do the math, like, profit's not happening. Like, that's not why we do it. Our application process is extensive, but we do that for the benefit of the dog and the adopter. It's important that it get them thinking, oh, you know what, I don't exercise that often, or, oh, I only am willing to go for one walk a day. And based on that information, we can really help find a good match. Or maybe it will make people realize that, oh, I'm gone 12 hours a day every day. This probably isn't the right time for me to bring a dog in. But I think that's kind of the two things that we get the most, is that we're just in it for resources and that we make it impossible for people to adopt.
But there are expenses.
There are expenses.
That is, raise money.
We have an amazing fundraising team. They work so hard. So we have typically the first week in November, we have our annual silent auction at the Holiday Inn. Every year we have sponsors, people donate physical goods so we can make baskets, and the community is so incredibly supportive of us. We are very, very lucky. The last few years, Giving Hearts Day has been incredible for us. It's easy, I think, for our donors and volunteers to get involved that way. We do a lot of local events at different breweries, restaurants. We'll do Dine to Donates. We have a lot of very simple things that are kind of out of the box that people love to jump in and support. You know, we do the regular things like merchandise sales, but it's the partnering with businesses within the community that really has been a very effective fundraising tool for us.
What mistakes do adopters make that you would like them to think about in advance?
Sure. So I think it's that knee-jerk kind of reaction, like,
oh, you're so cute, Gunny.
Yes. Or I want this puppy. And, you know, I think that it's a lot of commitment. And with any dog, adult, senior, if a dog is on a lot of medications that can be very costly, you know, we don't want to always think about that. We just love this dog and we want to bring this dog home, not thinking that there's extensive bills every month that come with providing the medication that they're on. So I think just reminding people to just kind of slow down and go through the process and listen to the fosters and listen to the adoption coordinators, because they know better than anybody what that particular dog's needs are.
At home, generally, what decisions do people need to make about their home, about preparing their home for a dog?
Sure. It's not that different, I don't think, than like baby proofing. I had a puppy once that came into the rescue that I fostered that had chewed an electrical cord and found himself in the emergency hospital. And his adopter, potential adopters, I came to their house and I just had to point out to them that this is a puppy that chews things. And so they had to go through and essentially baby proof their home to make sure that things were appropriate to bring a puppy in. So baby gates, to have areas of the house secluded off. off if you don't want the dog in the bedroom, making sure that everyone is shutting doors, being cognizant of going inside and outside, especially when you have children, and letting the dog sneak out past you, because accidents, unfortunately, can happen. So I think just the physical space and the doors and fencing, and fences are not required, but if we rely on a fence, just making sure that it is secure. Dogs are very good at sneaking out of small spaces. So just, you know, I will go in people's backyards with them and just like, let's make sure that everything is secure, and kind of looking at it, if you've never had a dog before, from a different perspective. With babies, they say, get down on the floor and see what a baby sees. And it's kind of the same for a dog. If you're someone that likes to keep your food on the counter and you get a big dog who is capable of counter surfing, like making sure that you put things back or put things in cupboards. So if you haven't had a dog before, it's just kind of readjusting your lifestyle to be appropriate for these guys.
What post-adoption guidance do you provide?
Within the two-week refrem period, we are happy to email back and forth. We have a group within the rescue that is our behavior team, and most everyone on our behavior team has some additional training within dog training. So if someone is struggling with crate training, or they're struggling with introduction to their other dog or to a cat, or if the dog has been nervous around the kids, our behavior team tries to offer them resources to help make those transitions just a little bit smoother.
Do you have a great success story you want to share with us? I'm sure you...
So many. So my kind of niche of foster is I typically take in dogs with ongoing medical needs. And I had this incredible little dog. His name was Matthew. And he was a...
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Who gets to name dogs?
Fosters, typically. We always kind of joke that if a foster picks up a dog or agrees to take this dog, that they get to pick the name. If we have litters, the fosters have a good time theme doing the litters. Our intake team sometimes has to come up with on a whim with coming up with names, but most of the time fosters get to name their dogs.
Back to your story.
Yeah, so Matthew was about a two-year-old mixed breed little dog that had been running loose on a reservation in North Dakota for quite some time, and they had a difficult time catching him. A team at a dentist office actually worked to catch him. He came into the rescue and we found that he had a heartworm disease. He had a diaphragmatic hernia, which means he had a hole in his diaphragm. So his organs in his abdomen were pushing up into his chest. And he had been, for whatever reason, had been shot, had BBs in him, and he had severe dental disease. So he was in my home for about 8 months and had to undergo surgery, emergency surgery for his diaphragmatic hernia. He had to be treated for heartworm disease, and he had a dental procedure and a neuter, and he went through all of this. And on the other side, he was just the most incredible, resilient, happy, silly dog who has an amazing adopter, and she sends me on Christmas every year. I get an email, and it's about 6 years since he was adopted, but I always think of him and what the rescue was willing to do for this one little fluffy dog who just was so incredible and so deserving. And that's the amazing thing about For Love of Dog Rescue, is where other places might say no, For Love of Dog Rescue will say yes, and they will take in very extensive medical cases, and we say yes, and then we figure out how to fund it later. We just believe that they deserve a shot and they deserve a chance, and we have the community that supports us, so we're able to provide that care for them.
Even with the support, Natalie, what's your biggest need?
Foster homes. We need foster homes. We can have all the resources in the world, but if we don't have places to put these guys when they come in, we can't take them. We need foster homes.
Your hopes and dreams for Love of Dog Rescue?
I hope we don't need to be around forever, right? Like, you hope that someday that they don't need us anymore and that all of these guys will get a home. But as long as there's dogs in need, we're going to be here and we're going to be working to provide a space for them.
Natalie Johnson-Metcalf is the president and volunteer of For Love of Dog Rescue.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts
for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. This is a time of year we often start to remember our traditions. Okay, well, maybe not all of them have lasted, like creating mock weddings. Here is a Plains Folk essay from Tom Ezern. Flash Pictures.
Mock weddings. Folk dramas featuring gender-bending, cross-dressing, and general hilarity became fixtures at bridal showers on the prairies in the early 20th century. By the 1950s, the girls who had staged these parodies of married life had become, we hope, mature women enjoying late middle age with their partners. The mock wedding then was reinvented as a fixture in wedding anniversary celebrations staged for popular couples, particularly in small towns, where people were accustomed to homegrown entertainment. This was the variety of mock wedding described by the folklorist who first described them, Michael Taft of Saskatchewan, in the 1970s. Notably, I think, the relative age of participants in the post-World War II period licensed them to engage in a sort of body irreverence that would have been inappropriate for unmarried women a generation earlier. Maturity also gave participants in the new generation of mock weddings a great store of experience to be deployed as plot motifs and inside jokes in such affectionate community theatrical expressions. The country correspondent in Pillsbury captured the sense of a mock wedding along these lines in early 1951. The production figured in a silver anniversary celebration for Mr. and Mrs. Sig Lee. The correspondent names names for the participants, a mixed-gender cast, although, of course, mostly dressed as the other gender. Presumably, they were honored to be included in such public notice. Those not present, the reporter says, don't know what they missed. Some are still laughing about the affair. In succeeding years, mock weddings were such expected rituals in anniversary celebrations that they received only casual mention. The program included a mock wedding. A mock wedding was given. Or perhaps, highlight of the evening was a mock wedding. Readers understood what was being talked about. The mock wedding was popular enough and acceptable enough to be offered as a program feature for general community celebrations. In 1953, for instance, the Farmers Union of Colgate enjoyed a mock wedding enactment scripted by their program chair, Mrs. Wes Reisenberg. The cast of the elaborate production included a bride, a groom, a minister, a mother and father of the bride, a best man, a bridesmaid, a flower girl, and a ring bearer, all named in the news report, most of them cross-dressing. This is not to be construed as any sort of gender-type rebellion. All the women involved were reported with their husband's name. Mrs. Ken Erickson, for instance, or in the case of unmarried participants, Miss Gladys Erickson. At this time, music was emerging as a popular and parodic element in mock weddings. The ambivalence was obvious when a soloist sang, "I Love You Truly" for the Colgate gathering. We can guess the inside joke when a second soloist rendered, "Yes, sir, that's my baby." The closing number was a rendition of the traditional folk song, "I Wish I Were Single Again." Speaking of music and gender bending, we note that for a 1954 mock wedding over in that crazy town Bismarck, the flower girl, Mr. Neil Snow, tossed cabbage leaves before the bride while singing, "I Love You Truly," in a falsetto voice. Another common musical element of the day was to get out an old Victor photograph and play wax cylinder recordings of songs that were popular at the time of the original marriage of the couple being honored through mockery. As if to say, this is how old these people are. Oh, and that 1951 mock wedding I mentioned in Pillsbury in 1951, we are told Glenn Plaisted took flash pictures. Do these photographs survive in a family album somewhere? Do descendants know what they are looking at? Oh, I hope so.
Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, an event that dives into the rich storytelling traditions of the MHA Nation.
How can you tell when a video is real or fabricated by artificial intelligence? Researchers are building defenses to protect your face and voice from so-called deepfakes.
It scrambles the signal such that it prevents the AI from generating an effective copycat.
Outfaking deepfakes on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and November is Native American Heritage Month, and there is an event coming up tomorrow at the Heritage Center in Bismarck that is a collaboration between the State Historical Society and the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation and the North Dakota Native American Tourism Alliance. It is happening at 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and it is on storytelling. We are joined now by Kiera Fox. She is the Marketing and Communications Coordinator with the Tourism Department for the MHA Nation. Kiera, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about this event. I understand it is a fairly specific time of year to focus on storytelling.
Yes. So as you know, Native American Heritage Month is in November. We figured it would be the perfect time to showcase and showcase our culture, our history, just to get that awareness out there. In a way, kind of re-educating those who don't know, I guess, much about Native Americans outside of textbooks. So with that, we figured this would be the awesome opportunity to showcase that in the city of Bismarck.
Yeah, let's focus a little bit on that phrase, re-educate, for those who don't know what's besides in the textbook, because the textbook telling, or at least when I was in school, presented a very one perspective, very much Indigenous people existing only in the past and then just sort of disappeared. so far from the truth.
Yes, exactly. And so that's why, like I said, this is why we're having this event, to show people who we are today and what we do in our, you know, modern times in this modern society. That we're not just in textbooks, you know, we're mm-hmm. outside of our stereotypes.
Yeah, walk us through a little bit this idea of blending, of honoring tradition, but putting it in sort of that modern lighting. Maybe just pick an example of, is it a kind of art, or is it a dance, or a way of telling stories, or what is your favorite way that explains how you can blend tradition and modernity?
So with technology, I've noticed that a lot of the times our culture is starting to come out a lot more. Hmm. And that's also kind of, I guess, a way to showcase how we are adapting our traditions into a modern way, is that we're able to get that awareness out there. We're able to spread the word. We're able to have these type of performances. We're able to have these type of storytelling events. We're able to showcase our modern and traditional foods as well. And I think that's awesome. And I'm so excited for this event.
What are you most excited about?
I'm really excited. Like, honestly, everybody's going to be excited about the food, obviously. I'm excited about all of it, all aspects of it. It all just fell into place. You know, we have cultural storytellers from MHA Nation, all of our dancers, MHA Nation, our singers, MHA Nation. And then as well, you know, I'm just really excited to share our culture with the city of Bismarck.
When do you feel the most connected with your culture?
You know, every day, every day is how I feel connected with my culture. I think about it, it's crazy because, you know, my job is tourism, so it's constantly on my mind. How can we spread culture? How can we attract visitors into our nation? You know, how can we show them?
Yeah, that gets a little bit into this concept of people tourism, and it's a term that makes some people uncomfortable.
Yes.
Give us, you know, at least the MHA tourism department's stand on what it means to be a responsible tourist that does incorporate this idea of people tourism.
So we actually have like a POWA etiquette for those who come in and visit. And so it really, in a way, is that we have lots of people, lots of tourists that come in, and a lot of the time our tours are really immersive. We have hands-on activities, you know, we have dancers come in. We just try to give them, you know, our experiences here on in our nation, and we are very open to all questions, you know. We're very, you know, hospitality is our tradition. It has been our tradition for centuries. So
what are some of your favorite kinds of questions to get asked?
My favorite one is always hearing, are we allowed on the reservation? Are we allowed to come over? You know, like, yes, of course you are. You can come over. You know, we have these huge powwows throughout the summer, annual powwows. We have our rodeos, you know, we have all these things that a lot of people don't think we have.
Do you talk at all about, for example, the difference between cultural appreciation and cultural appropriation, or is it more just, hey, we're here to have fun? We can learn, but we're here to have fun.
Yeah, basically, we're here to have fun, and like I said, there's ask questions. We're here to answer that answer those questions. You know, no matter how ridiculous you may think they seem, they're not ridiculous to us. We're here to educate. We're here to re-educate. Like you know, like I said earlier, you know, we're just trying to basically tell our stories with our own voices.
We are visiting today with Kiera Fox. She is the Marketing and Communications Coordinator for the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation's Tourism Department. There is an event coming up 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. tomorrow at the Heritage Center in Bismarck for Native American Heritage Month. Kiera, walk us through a little bit what people can expect at this event.
Yes, of course. So what we're expecting at this event, obviously, we're going to have our dancer performances. So we're going to have all of our dancers that you would see at our powwows, our annual powwows. And in between, you will hear from our storytellers here from MHA Nation that will give you kind of like a little bit of history of MHA from, you know, pre-colonization to now. And then as well as, you know, checking out our native vendor booths and then our food samples.
What can people expect food-wise?
Food-wise, so we will have traditional and modern food. We will be having catering from United Tribes who will be doing our traditional food. And then Frybed Mamas, which is a MHA-owned restaurant out of Bismarck. And they will be doing our modern food.
Can you talk to us a little bit more, Kiera, about how events like this kind of work and why you want to have it at the Heritage Center? You know, it can be a difficult thing, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on a Tuesday. Who is the intended audience?
Yeah, so I realize the time is a little iffy, but we figured this would be the best time, you know, being Thanksgiving week where family's coming into town. it would be, you know, it was my thinking is that there's going to be family members showing their family members around. What is there to do in Bismarck? You know, here's the Heritage Center. Heritage Center has a lot of foot traffic, you know, it's an awesome place. I love it there. But yeah, so our intended audience is, you know, out of town visitors, as well as some of the schools within Bismarck. And I know a few schools that are actually coming from South Dakota and then from the surrounding reservations as well.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, recently there was the move to include more truthfully told and appropriately expressed Indigenous curriculum in school. Have you seen the changes yet as people are interacting with either the MHA Nation or with the North Dakota Native American Tourism Alliance to figure out ways to expand that curriculum?
Yeah, actually, that's a great question because we've actually had an event in Watford City for a cultural exchange where we had our dancers go in and, you know, dance, and we had explained what each of those dances meant, and we had our singers there and as well as food samples. So there's a lot of school districts actually reaching out to MHA Tourism wanting a demonstration of Native culture and foods and history.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of how many people you reach in a given year?
I honestly have no clue. I wish I knew, but I know the reach is quite large because, you know, MHA Tourism, we've done performances like this, showcase performances like this at the North Dakota State Fair. And, you know, we do get a lot of people that reach out to us about wanting dancers, you know, in their area.
Sure.
How can we do this? You know, things like that.
Is there a change at all in how the cultural information is presented when it's a group from the MHA Nation, for example, going to a predominantly white space versus other people coming to the traditional ancestral homelands? Is there a difference between those cultural experiences?
I mean, I don't believe so from what I, you know, see. I think it's kind of like we have a set way of how we do things, how we do cultural performances, how we I guess, educate on tribal tourism. So, yeah, I think I don't really see a big difference in between that.
What other kinds of projects are you working on?
So currently we're working on this one, and then we're also planning again for the state fair. And then as well as just getting our, you know, booking site up for our tours and just, you know, kind of just getting our marketing material up during this long winter break.
Now, I noticed, Kiara, that you hold a degree from the Institute of American Indian Arts, a BFA in Indigenous Liberal Studies. Just adding that word on, Indigenous Liberal Studies, what are some things that are added to a Liberal Studies degree when you get to have that Indigenous, for want of a better term, an Indigenous perspective?
Yeah, so with my degree, you know, my Indigenous Liberal Studies degree, it is definitely something that I never really thought I would be able to get growing up. But what it is basically it helps you kind of identify and create solutions for your community. How can you do this? How can we do that? You know, in a very unique way that other, I guess, cultures may not have. We're in a very unique perspective. So a lot of the ways we deal with things have to be dealt with in a very particular way. So yeah, it's really interesting because it really does open up doors that I never really thought of when I was younger. And then getting that degree makes me realize that, yeah, we can do this. We can definitely do this. How do we go about it? How can I do that? I want this to be able, you know, I want to bring this to my community and be able to utilize my education.
Kiara Fox is the Marketing and Communications Coordinator with the Tourism Department for the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation. There is an event coming up tomorrow, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Heritage Center in Bismarck, celebrating Native American Heritage Month. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Hi, I'm Jack Zaleski. I'm the former editorial page editor and a current columnist for the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead, and I've been a newspaper man for life. But no matter what the media and public radio is included, journalism is a vital pillar of democracy. We're seeing what happens with a superpower whose leader goes unchecked by a free and independent press. We've seen democracy and the media under attack right here in this country. It is always important to support your trusted sources of journalism. So keep reading and subscribing to your area newspapers, digital or in print. Become a member of your local public radio station, Prairie Public. And we journalists will continue to seek the truth no matter what we uncover.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 20th. A murderer fleeing town only to settle in a quaint community to start a quiet life sounds like an overused trope. However, that's what happened in Minot over 25 years ago. Dr. Robert Birnbaum was a plastic surgeon and a cherished member of the community. He moved to Minot in 1996. Originally from New York, people were initially cautious of him. They slowly opened up as he began ingratiating himself into the community, publishing a bagel recipe in a local paper, and flying members of the Rotary Club to Mexico to offer medical services to orphans. However, 2 years after his arrival in Minot, New York City investigators, along with Dale Maxner, a special agent with the North Dakota Bureau of Criminal Investigation, confronted Birnbaum on the steps of Trinity Clinic. He invoked his right to counsel, but in December of 2000, investigators arrested him for the murder of his wife, Gail Katz Birnbaum. A New York Times article from October 30th of 2000 stated he was set to be charged with murder on this date. The article details the mix of emotions Minot citizens were feeling. Mike Berg, a friend from the Rotary Club, expressed anger, saying, "Going to other states and acting like you're innocent? It's still wrong, and you didn't face it." Berg still sent an email to Birnbaum, wishing him luck with the trial. Daryl Williams, an eye surgeon and one of Birnbaum's closest friends, thought that Birnbaum should be allowed to work on a work release program, stating, "I feel grief, like someone has died. It's the loss of his life and the good he does to help other people." Another account paints a different picture. Elaine Katz, Gail Birnbaum's sister, told of a double date with the Birnbaums, witnessing Birnbaum forcefully shoving sushi into her sister's mouth and attempted the same with her. Another time, Gail called Elaine crying after Birnbaum attempted to drown her cat in their toilet. Gail herself had reported an incident to police about Birnbaum choking her to the point of unconsciousness when he caught her smoking. Despite the report, nothing came of it. Then she went missing on July 7, 1985. Birnbaum had claimed she stormed out after an argument. Eventually, at a parole hearing in December of 2021, Birnbaum confessed to murdering his wife and tossing her body into the Atlantic from an airplane. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
This is Bird Note. When winter turns the world white, some animals of the northern latitudes follow suit. Call it a seasonal change of camouflage. Best known is the ermine, a small weasel whose fur changes from brown to snow white in winter. A few birds also change color. One such is the willow ptarmigan, a chicken-sized bird of the northern tundra known for its giddy voice. The willow ptarmigan, feathered mostly brown in summer, is utterly transfigured by an autumn molt. As snow begins to mantle its world, the newly white-feathered ptarmigan blends in superbly. Where a covey of ptarmigan sit with feathers fluffed up against the cold, they resembled nothing so much as a row of oversized snowballs. Only a flick of their black tail feathers gives them away. The ptarmigan pulls yet another winter trick. It adds dense feathering, white, of course, on both the tops and bottoms of its feet, and its claws grow longer. The winter ptarmigan actually quadruples the bearing surface of its feet, which is to say, the bird grows snowshoes. Well, it's no wonder why the ptarmigan likes a good laugh. Take a good look at the chameleon bird, the ptarmigan, on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Bird Note, the segment that dives into the lives of birds and the environment, is having an important fundraiser. We learn about the importance of birds and how we can support them. We also hear from an NDSU student who is the recent recipient of a scholarship that allowed her to meet former President Obama. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.